They are firmly dealt with. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading, A Decisive Strike, Indeed. Stay tuned for more. There are no reports yet of the exact number of Zionists killed or wounded, but the missile barrage in the early hours of Sunday on an Israeli regime spying center in Erbil, Iraqi Kurdistan, ought to make the enemies of humanity realize that the Islamic Republic of Iran is serious in its avowed vengeance for the innocent blood of martyrs. Terrorism, whether by the racist Zionist entity or by the CENTCOM terrorists, or for that matter by their agents, including Pejak traders and the macabrely murderous Takfiri outfits, should be rooted out in order to make the whole of West Asia stable and secure. Iran, as the prime victim of various sorts of terrorism by the U.S. and its proxies, has long endured with patience the assassination of its nationals and the damage to its economy, in the hope that the hostile elements would come to their senses to remove tensions and the unnecessary shedding of blood. It, however, seems the enemies of humanity are harebrained, not willing to give up their crimes and acts of terrorism unless they are firmly dealt with. The Erbil events are a clear warning in this regard and an indication that the next round of retaliation would be more devastating if the terrorists continue to target Iranian citizens and Iran's national interests in the region. Be sure, when Iran decides to act, it does it decisively and not in a half-hearted way. And there is no limit to reach of its vengeance when it deems the time has come. Of course, the Islamic Republic does not harm innocent people of any country, nor does it violate the territorial integrity and sovereignty of its neighbors while meting out the deserving punishment to the murderous culprits. This is fully evident in all its cross-border operations, including the latest one on the Israeli regime spying center in Erbil. Iran's missile barrage has been welcomed by the brotherly Iraqi nation and freedom-loving Kurdish people of Iraq, who detest being burdened by the unwanted presence in their towns and cities of the despicable Zionists, the hated Americans, and the traitorous Pejak. Tyranny is short-lived and justice finally prevails, thanks to human conscience that does not tolerate oppression of fellow humans. This means there are many conscientious persons in various parts of the world willing to be instruments of justice against terrorists without receiving any orders from Tehran. No amount of gadgets or security personnel can deter such conscientious persons who are capable of piercing the protective cordon around the sensitive sites of the tyrannical regimes or the notorious murderers themselves. Recently, we heard a report that the U.S. is spending $2 million per month to keep the criminal called Mike Pompeo alive, and the amount for warding off the impending death away from the dastardly murderer, Donald Trump, might be many times more. The question is, would the squandering of the American taxpayers' hard-earned money for shielding terrorists from justice prolong the miserable life of the murderers of the Hammer of Terrorists, General Qasem Soleimani? Definitely not, since Iran's avowed vengeance has not yet materialized, and maybe the conscientious, justice-loving people of the U.S. will take their responsibility upon themselves to defang the devils, even in other parts of the world, unknown to the Islamic Republic and without any involvement on its part. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Images from the war in Ukraine have dominated the headlines over the last few weeks. But the Jewish identity of Ukraine's President Zelensky has been used by many in the West to cover NATO's clear alliance with neo-Nazi battalions in the war against Russia. But it's not just NATO that's working with these neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine. Israel is arming, and its military personnel are even fighting alongside explicitly neo-Nazi units. To find out more, I'll be speaking to a couple of experts after this report from Bianca Rahimi.
As the battle for Ukraine rages, we ask about the involvement of the Zionist regime in the conflict and any affinities between neo-Nazi currents in the Ukrainian military and the racist ideas inherent in the Zionist movement. The Zionist regime has supplied arms to the Ukraine military, including the Nazi Azov Battalion. Azov Battalion members have been photographed toting Tivor rifles built by Israeli Military Industries, a subsidiary of Elbit Systems. In 2018, it was revealed that a Ukrainian military training school website indicates that training is provided by former Israeli Defense Force officers. Israelis have been confirmed as joining the fight against Russia, and Ukrainian Zionists from the extremist Chabad-Lubavitch sect have also signed up with the Ukraine military. The neo-Nazi Azov Battalion reportedly included a number of Jewish recruits. But the connections with Zionism go much deeper. Numerous prominent Zionists hailed from the Ukraine, including two former chiefs of the Israel Defense Forces and five presidents or prime ministers of the Zionist entity. Odessa in southern Ukraine has been referred to as the Gates of Zion. For example, the revisionist Zionist leader Vladimir Jabotinsky hailed from Odessa. Jabotinsky historically supported the Ukrainian nationalists, including their leader Simon Petliura. Zionist sources today credit Petliura with responsibility for the deaths of 50,000 Jews in the pogroms in the 1920s. But Jabotinsky maintained that Petliura was not an anti-Semite, even going so far as to state, "When I die, you can write on my grave, this was the person who signed an agreement with Petliura." Following the Western-sponsored coup in Ukraine in 2014, a school was named after Jabotinsky in Odessa in 2016. The Ukrainian nationalists under Stepan Bandera collaborated with the Nazis in the 1939 to 1945 war. Today he is revered by the Ukrainian far right. The openly Nazi Azov Battalion has now been incorporated into the Ukrainian armed forces. Much has been made of the fact that the president of the Ukraine, Zelensky, is Jewish, with the implication that he would not collaborate with Nazis. In fact, Zelensky is the protege of a powerful Ukrainian oligarch, Igor Kolomoisky. Kolomoisky, who has both Ukrainian and Israeli citizenship, owned Privat Bank, a company from which he is accused of looting more than $5 billion. Zelensky was the beneficiary of a network of shell companies set up to send cash from Kolomoisky offshore. Kolomoisky set up his own militia in 2014 and also funded the neo-Nazi Azov Battalion. Zelensky has ceded power to the far right in Ukraine and now depends on them as frontline fighters. On March 1st, Zelensky again showed the practical alliance with the far right by appointing Colonel Maxim Marchinka as the new governor of Odessa. Marchenko was the commander of the neo-Nazi Adar Brigade, accused of Daesh-style war crimes in 2014. The Zionist regime and its supporters are intimately involved in Ukraine. Both historically and now, the Zionist movement is allied with the Ukrainian far right.
We're joined today by the British-Iraqi hip-hop artist and activist who's a patron of the Stop the War Coalition. Loki's also the host of the Watchdog podcast on Mint Press, which investigates secretive organisations and powerful vested interests. We'll hear from Loki in a moment. Our resident expert, David Miller, will also be giving us the benefit of his insights. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading scholarly critic of Israel. He co-founded and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. Welcome to the show. Loki, can I start with you? Can you tell us what's the relationship between Zelensky and the far right?
Well, essentially, Zelensky has overseen the integration into the Ukrainian state of several explicitly neo-Nazi movements. He awarded towards the end of the last year the Hero of Ukraine Award to one of the main fighters from the right sector organization, which is one of the Banderite organizations. In addition to that, he appointed as advisor to Commander-in-Chief of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, Dmitry Yurosh, another very visible fighter from the right sector. As was mentioned, he has appointed as the governor of Odessa, one of the Ida battalion. And overall, what we see here is a push to really put the Ukrainian state at the need of these major neo-Nazi groups.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, David, people talk about the fog of war, don't they? And an example of this is that Ukraine can't possibly have a problem with Nazis because the president's Jewish. What do you say to that?
I would say, you know, let's look back at his inaugural speech when he became president. And in there, in the official translation on the government website, he talks about Ukraine becoming like Israel and defending its native land. Now, of course, that's a very strongly Zionist thing to say, but it also points out the strong confluence there is between Zionist ideas and Ukrainian nationalist ideas. These are far-right ideas which depend on an ethno-conception of the state. And of course, these work very well with the far-right. So Zelensky himself, yes, he's Jewish, but he's also, you know, strongly oriented towards Israel, but that in itself is a sign of being oriented really towards the far right. And the evidence all, as Loki's just been saying, is that he has moved towards the far right. He's tried politically to distance himself from them, but in practice he depends on them as frontline fighters.
Right. Loki, I mean, I wonder whether you could explain for our viewers what the relationship is between Zelensky and this oligarch, Igor Kolomoyskyi.
Well, Igor Kolomoyskyi, a triple citizen, even though it's illegal in Ukrainian law, of Ukraine, Cyprus, and the Israeli regime. He's also a citizen of that entity. Now, he was the backer of the TV shows, which Zelensky was a major star of, and he was able to take him from being that star to his landslide victory in the presidential election of 2019. He was the top funder of Zelensky. Now, what's interesting is in addition to funding Zelensky, Igor Kolomoyskyi funded the Azov battalion and the Idar battalion as well at the same time, essentially. The period of thrusting Zelensky in front of the masses on TV, Kolomoyskyi was also funding these explicitly right-wing and neo-Nazi groups.
Interesting. I mean, David, I mean, there's a lot of people on the left are saying word to the effect that, look, there's Nazis everywhere, so we shouldn't get hung up with a few Nazis in Ukraine. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, I've heard people say that. I've heard them say, look, the Nazis in Spain are doing well in the elections. Certainly there's Nazis in Russia, and there are Nazis in this country too, but none of them are in government. None of them are in prime positions in the military, in the police. The Azov Brigade's street army is deployed alongside the national police across the Ukraine. This is an army of thugs, which is there to intimidate anyone who steps out of line. And that means, of course, people who are seen to be Russian or pro-Russian. It probably also means, and it has been in terms of their ideology, Jews too. Although, of course, there are some Zionists who are fighting on the other side.
Interesting, yeah. And, Loki, is there a precedent for NATO, or even Israel for that matter, associating so closely with neo-Nazis? I mean, it seems extraordinary.
Well, I think the key point that was mentioned in the clip that you showed was about Vladimir Jabotinsky. This is not some minor fringe figure within the Zionist movement. There is no other figure in Zionist history who has more streets, more hotels, more cinemas, more parks, more schools named after them within occupied Palestine 48 than Vladimir Jabotinsky. Now, his followers went on to be the Stern Gang, the well-known terrorist organization that targeted British soldiers and Palestinians, of course, more. Well, in 1941, and this is historical fact, the Stern Gang wrote a letter to the Nazi government of Germany offering to enter the war on the Nazi side and supporting the Madagascar plan. There is a long history of this intertwining of the idea, as Theodor Herzl put it, that the anti-Semites of Europe will be the best friends of the Zionist movement because they will provide the Zionist movement with the human material through which the state can be built. It doesn't matter how people feel about it. These are historical facts about how we came to be where we are today.
Sure. That's really interesting, fascinating insight, Loki. And I wonder as well, so the question I'd just like to ask you is, what do you think explains why Israel's arming the Azov battalion with these Tavo rifles? I mean, is it facing any kind of pushback for that?
Well, when you look at the general NATO policy of pumping Ukraine full of weapons since 2014, there, you know, Poroshenko, the coup, the president after the coup, the US-backed coup, said publicly on TV he thanked the Swedes, the British and the Americans for sending the weapons. NATO nations were generally pumping this area full of weapons in order to draw the Russian state into a quagmire. So when the Israeli regime sends the Tavor rifles to Azov, they are merely part of this general push which is taking place.
Yeah, it's certainly a tangled web. And, well, thanks very much indeed, both of you, for that. But we'll come back for a further discussion shortly.
They gathered from all corners.
Chabad Lubavitch is an ultra-Orthodox Jewish sect with more than 10,000 emissaries in 100 countries worldwide. There are 52 centers in Ukraine and around 150 emissaries. Chabad is a dominant force in the Jewish community in Ukraine. Dnipro, Ukraine is the home to the largest Chabad, indeed the largest Jewish center in the world. Its benefactor was Ukrainian oligarch Igor Kolomoisky. But what is Chabad Lubavitch? Founded in the small Russian town of Lyubaveki near the border with Belarus, it is a messianic sect which believes Jews are the chosen people. According to Haaretz, Chabad's key religious texts state that non-Jews have only animal souls, not human souls. It runs a children's group called the Army of Hashem, which in the words of the leader of the sect, the Rebbe who died in 1994, is dedicated to waging war against non-Judaism. The supremacism of Chabad is nowhere more evident and pointed than in its activities in Palestine. A book called The King's Torah, written by two Chabadi rabbis from the notorious Yitzhar illegal settlement, justifies the killing of Palestinian children. It's not just words either. Chabad Lubavitch is heavily involved in the furthest extremes of the settler movement in Palestine. Chabad Lubavitch opposes returning any land at all to Palestinians, and according to the Zionist intelligence agency, Shin Bet, almost all price tag revenge attacks on Palestinians are carried out by followers of the sect. Chabad has links with the movement of the extremist Rabbi Meir Kahan, whose organization, the Jewish Defense League, was designated as a terrorist organization by the FBI. Chabad was reportedly implicated in funneling money from the US to Israel for Kahani. Today, it is deeply implicated in alleged fraud and embezzlement by Ukrainian oligarch Igor Kolomoisky. The Department of Justice has filed 4 separate actions against Kolomoisky, who is banned from entering the US. 2 Chabad leaders are specifically named in the charges. Given this history, it's no surprise that Chabad Lubavitch is integral to the events in Ukraine and is aligned with the far-right Ukrainian nationalist.
David, what can you tell us about this mysterious Chabad Lubavitch sect and what's its role in the Zionist movement?
It performs a very interesting role. They have this thing called shluchim, which is a word for emissaries, and they send emissaries all around the world. They have 10,000 of them, they say, in 100 countries. And the role of the shluchim is to encourage people to return to Jewish religious practice and to return to certain forms of Orthodox practice. And it's used as a way of bringing people into to Zionism by encouraging religious observance, even for non-Orthodox Jews. In a way, it's a funny thing because they don't really regard Reform and liberal and progressive Jews as being real Jews, and it's an extraordinary sort of thing. But it's used to proselytize for the Zionist movement as well as for Orthodox Judaism, and it's of course leaned on by the Zionist movement more properly known. The Jewish Agency, for example, has adopted the same term shluchim for its emissaries, and it sends emissaries from Israel all across Britain and all across many other Western countries. And so it's used as a kind of cutting edge for expanding the influence of Zionism, even although it appears simply to be a religious organization.
Interesting. I mean, even the infamous Zionist intelligence agency, Shin Bet, seems sceptical about Chabad Lubavitch. I mean, why do you think its role in revenge attacks on Palestinians isn't better known? I mean, people need to be aware about this.
It's a truly extraordinary story, isn't it? These are people who are involved in daily attacks and humiliations of Palestinians. It's well known in Palestine that this is the case. The Zionist press regularly talks about it, and many of the things in the report you've just seen, the quotes come from Zionist press articles. But outside of Palestine, it's regarded as being a sort of cuddly and interesting Jewish local organization which will bring you in for a Shabbat supper and will be nice to the local Jews and indeed to non-Jews. Mm. But actually, you know, when you look a little bit deeper, the theology underlying this, you saw that in the clip just there, the idea of a war against non-Judaism. It's a little bit frightening when people begin to think of that, how that might relate to the attacks on Palestinians, but also how that might relate to the views of this organization in terms of people in this country. So it's extremely surprising, really, when you see this, that hardly anybody in this country has any idea that this is the kind of organization it is.
Well, hopefully what we're doing today will have illuminated a few more people. But look, I mean, the FBI's banned the Ukrainian oligarch Kolomoisky and his family from the US and named 2 senior Chabad leaders as being intimately involved in his alleged looting and fraud in the United States. But how does that relate, do you think, to the conflict in Ukraine?
Well, the money, over $5 billion, it's said, was looted by Kolomoisky from a bank. This is only from the bank we're talking about. And it was done by a network of shell companies, which President Zelensky also benefited from. But these two guys, the Chabad guys in Florida, who've taken millions and millions of dollars, spread it around real estate and spread it around Chabadi charities in New York and indeed in Florida. This has been a means to get the money out of Ukraine. So it's been a means which has contributed to the destabilization of Ukraine. So that's one way in which it has contributed. But it's also contributed in the sense that Kolomoisky is absolutely central to the encouragement of the neo-Nazis and the pursuit of the power of President Zelensky. So there's a very strong connection here between the Chabad movement, which of course is supported in the Ukraine by Kolomoisky, and the whole neo-Nazi question. So these are very closely connected, and you know, truly extraordinary as a picture of what's happening in Ukraine now.
Absolutely. I mean, Loki, I wonder whether you could sum up for us how you think this Kolomoisky network relates to NATO's activities in Ukraine.
Well, essentially, since 2008, at least, at the Bucharest summit, you had NATO put very clearly in their conclusions that Ukraine would join the alliance. This is black and white and available on the NATO website. When you look at this funneling of money into building up what would become the bulwark of the Ukrainian state against Russia, then you see quite clearly how Kolomoisky and NATO's interests have intertwined. It's also important to point out that historically it's been said that if we were to list every single former Nazi that worked with NATO, that was sort of subsumed into NATO following World War II, it would take something like 3,000 pages. For example, you look at Sidney Gottlieb and his innovative work in terms of torture and developing MK Ultra. It took place with a team of Nazi doctors and scientists. There's so many other examples of the way in which US policy has integrated into it Nazi figures. So really, this is not a historical aberration at all.
No, indeed. I mean, what do you think the end game is here, though? I mean, this is a...
What it seems to me...
We're on the precipice, aren't we, of potentially of a third world war here. I mean, so, you know, what on earth is going on?
Well, you have a few contradictions happening. On one hand, if the United States has separated Russia off from Europe, essentially, meaning that US companies will benefit massively from now being the source of gas for Europe. They have sidelined the Nord Stream pipeline, which was a major objective of US companies, no doubt. But then also, in addition to that, they seek in the long term to, through these sanctions, bring down the Russian government and either balkanize Russia or potentially, it's been said in recent days, integrate Russia into NATO itself. The other side, which may harm US interests, is of course when you push something like 3 billion people in Russia, India and China towards each other to trade in currencies other than dollars, what you have is quite serious ramifications economically for the United States. So it's quite a short-sighted policy, I would say.
I mean, those economic ramifications, David, I mean, they're also going to be felt potentially very acutely in Europe, aren't they? Have the political leaders taken leave of their senses? I mean, they're imposing these sanctions, but I've seen various commentators say that these are going to blow back on European citizens, on British citizens, with higher energy prices, higher food prices, and potential shortages of both. I mean, is the truth of that? What do you think?
That's right. I mean, it will blow back. It will blow back in that sense, in the economic sense. It will lead to hardship in this country. Fuel prices will increase, and that will be a significant effect. There will be blowback in terms of the neo-Nazis, of people who've gone to fight there, who come back to this country and will commit to attacks like has been the case in the past, where the Ukrainian terrorists in this country have killed people, including, for example, the well-known campaigner Mas Salim. Her father was killed by a Ukrainian neo-Nazi. But also, I think the other question, which Karim touched on, is that this is about the possibility of ending a unipolar world. If you push those people together, maybe they'll be joined by Venezuela, Iran, by Bolivia, by Cuba, and then you've got the beginnings of the end of the US empire. Once the SWIFT payment system, which has now been stopped in Russia, Russia's excluded from that, they will have to develop alternatives. Alternative internet, if they're censored, and that's going to lead potentially to the possibility of an emerging alternative power base which will challenge the US empire much more pointedly than this conflict has.
I mean, briefly, Loki, what do you think the future is then for the petrodollar as a result of this?
Well, I think it's inevitable that you will see major, major ramifications depending on what happens in Ukraine. I think that if you were right now sitting in the United States, what you would want was to increase this period of time. You know, Hillary Clinton actually put it this way: we are looking at the Afghanistan model. And when she means the Afghanistan model, she's talking about 1979, when the United States were able to draw the Soviet Union into occupation of Afghanistan. So really, they are working for a long-term goal, which I think will be hard for them to achieve, no matter how many javelin pieces of weaponry that they send in there, or the Thales star streak. No matter how they try to encourage this quagmire, I don't think it's going to go on for quite as long as they hope it will. So it may well backfire.
OK. Well, listen, thanks very much, both of you, David and Loki, for your illuminating insights. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis. So until next time on Palestine Declassified, bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The Limelight.
The world's main football governing body, FIFA, along with other international sports organizations, has done nothing to hold the Israeli regime accountable for its crimes against Palestinian sports. FIFA's double standards are abhorrent, to say the least. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ramzi Barood, journalist. This article is titled, Politics and Sports Do Mix, on FIFA's hypocrisy in Palestine and the need to isolate the Zionist regime. Here's the story. The Zionist regime's war on Palestinian sports is as old as the Israeli regime itself. For Palestinians, sport is a critical aspect of their popular culture, and since Palestinian culture itself is a target for the ongoing Israeli regime attack on Palestinian life in all of its manifestations, sports and athletes have been purposely targeted as well. Yet, the world's main football governing body, FIFA, along with other international sports organizations, has done nothing to hold the Zionist regime accountable for its crimes against Palestinian sports. Now that FIFA, along with UEFA, the International Olympic Committee, IOC, and others, have swiftly joined the West anti-Russia measures as a result of the latter's operation in Ukraine on February 24th, Palestinians and their supporters are puzzled. Years of relentless advocacy to sanction the Zionist regime at international sports competitions have paid little or no dividends. This has continued to be the case despite the numerous documented facts of the Zionist regime's intentional targeting of Palestinian stadiums, travel restrictions on athletes, the cancellation of sports events, the arrest and even killing of Palestinian footballers. Many Palestinians, Arabs and international activists have already highlighted the issue of Western hypocrisy in the case of the Zionist regime's military occupation of Palestine by the apartheid Israeli regime within hours of the start of the Russian operation. Almost immediately, an unprecedented wave of boycotts and sanctions of everything Russian, including music, art, theater, literature, and of course sports, kicked in. What took the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa decades to achieve was carried out against Russia in a matter of hours and days. Palestinians are justified to be baffled, since they have been informed by FIFA time and again that sports and politics don't mix. Marvel at this hypocrisy to truly appreciate Palestinian frustration. The FIFA Council acknowledges that the current situation in Palestine is for reasons that have nothing to do with football, characterized by an exceptional complexity and sensitivity, and by certain de facto circumstances that can neither be ignored nor changed unilaterally by non-governmental organizations such as FIFA, unquote. That was in part the official FIFA position declared in October 2017, in response to a Palestinian request that the six Israeli football clubs based in illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories should either relocate to the occupied territories or be banned from FIFA-recognized competitions. 2 years later, the Zionist regime so callously cancelled the FIFA Palestine Cup that was meant to bring Gaza's top football team, Khadamat Rafah Club, and the West Bank's FC Balata together in a dramatic final. Palestinians perceive football as a respite from the hardship of life under siege and occupation. The highly anticipated event would have been a moment of precious unity among Palestinians, and would have been followed by a large number of people, regardless of their political affiliation or geographic location. But, and for no apparent reason, as reported in The Nation, the Zionist regime decided to deny Palestinians that brief moment of joy. Even then, FIFA did nothing, despite the fact that the event itself carried the name FIFA. Meanwhile, outright racist Israeli regime football teams, the likes of Betar Football Club, are allowed to play unhindered, to travel unrestricted, and to echo either their favorite racist cheers, as if racism in sports is accepted routine. FIFA's double standards are abhorrent, to say the least. But FIFA is not the only hypocrite. On March 3rd, the International Paralympics Committee, IPC, went as far as denying athletes from Russia and Belarus the right to compete at this year's Winter Paralympics held in Beijing. The decision was justified on the basis that having these athletes participate in the Games was jeopardizing the viability of the events and supposedly making the safety of athletes untenable, despite the fact that the Russian and Belarusian athletes were, due to political context, set to take part as neutrals. Not only are Israeli regime athletes welcomed in all international sports events, the mere attempt by individual athletes to register a moral stance in support of Palestinians by refusing to compete against Israelis can be very costly. Algerian judoka Fehi Nourin, for example, was suspended along with his coach for 10 years for withdrawing from the 2020 Tokyo Olympics to avoid meeting an Israeli opponent. The same course of action was taken against the other players and teams for displaying symbolic solidarity with Palestine, or even fans for merely raising Palestinian flags or chanting for Palestinian freedom. Thank you. Mohamed Abu Trika, the former captain of the Egyptian national football team, was censured by FIFA in 2009 for merely displaying a shirt that read, in both Arabic and English, "Sympathize with Gaza." For that supposedly egregious act, the Confederation of African Football, a branch of FIFA, warned him against mixing politics with sports. About the double standards of FIFA, Abu Trika recently said in a media interview that the decision to suspend Russian clubs and teams from all competitions must be accompanied by a ban on those affiliated with the Zionist regime, because the Zionist regime has been killing children and women in Palestine for years. It must be stated that the hypocrisy here goes well beyond Palestine, into numerous situations where those demanding justice and accountability are often affiliated with poor nations from the global south or causes that challenge the status quo, such as the Black Lives Matter movement, among others. But there is much more that can be done aside from merely delineating the double standards or decrying the hypocrisy. True, it took the South African anti-apartheid movement many years to isolate the racist apartheid government in Pretoria at international sports platforms around the world. But that seemingly impossible task was eventually achieved. Palestinians, too, must now use these channels and platforms to continue pushing for justice and accountability.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
Is Britain being run by a clown? If the rumours are true, that is the view of French President Emmanuel Macron, who was also reported by a satirical French magazine as having said that Johnson had the attitude of a vulgarian. These comments came to light after Macron objected to Johnson's decision to publicly tweet a letter containing a five-point plan to tackle the issue of migrants who use small boats to cross the English Channel, and specifically after the fatal sinking of one boat, costing at least 27 lives.
In a public statement, Macron explained, "I spoke with Prime Minister Johnson in a serious way. I continue to do that, as I do with all countries and all leaders. I am surprised by methods when they are not serious. We do not communicate from one leader to another by tweets and letters that we make public. Macron is alleged to have added privately, Bojo talks to me at full speed, everything is going fine, we have discussions like big people. And then he gives us a hard time, before or afterwards, in an inelegant way. It's always the same circus." Prime Minister Johnson's actions and Macron's responses have revealed the impact recent developments have had on Anglo-French relations. Macron has claimed Brexit was the starting point of what he called the Johnson Circus, and claimed problems such as the petrol crisis that blighted Britain, plus other product shortages, arose from the UK's withdrawal from the EU. He added Johnson portrayed himself as the victim and France as the scapegoat, adding, "In private he says he's sorry to behave like this, but he says that he has to consider public opinion over everything else."
What are we to make of the trading of criticisms between President Macron and Prime Minister Johnson? And why can America no longer seem able to fix poor relations between European countries? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with strong words from the former French ambassador, Sylvie Berman, who said Anglo-French relations haven't been this bad since the Battle of Waterloo. How does the public feel France and Britain are getting on? We put that to them here in central London. This is what they said.
I have no idea, I'm sorry.
Are you French? We're here in Westminster. Thank you for coming on.
Just 5 questions, then. Thanks for stopping. Probably not the best person to ask.
Oh.
Sorry.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Yeah. Question one. The former French ambassador says Anglo-French relations haven't been this bad since the Battle of Waterloo. How do you feel France and Britain are getting along?
Well, I think it would be better to answer your question in a way of why don't we be sensible and step back and use statements like approach. As an ordinary citizen, I'm distressed.
Not very well at all. I think they should stay their side of the channel.
I think there have been far worse periods in Anglo-French relations since the Battle of Waterloo. I mean, do you remember what happened in the World War II when we blew up half their navy in the Mediterranean? I think relations were a bit more sour then, but I'd say it could be far worse.
I would say that France and Britain aren't quite as bad as the Battle of Waterloo, but it certainly seems like the situation's deteriorating. It would be good to have a bit more civility on both sides.
I wouldn't really know. I think we're not as strong as we used to be, as like a friendship, say, but I wouldn't know, honestly.
Well, it is clearly a deteriorating situation. That's for political reasons. President Macron's facing difficult elections in April. He sees political capital in picking a fight with the UK over Brexit, fish, migrants. I don't think we're going to get any improvement until after those elections in April.
Since Waterloo? I have no idea.
He's probably not far wrong, actually, or she, if it's a lady ambassador. I think relations aren't good, but I think it's chiefly between the two at the top.
I think we're getting along OK. I think it has been quite tense recently, but I don't think, like, COVID's not really helped that.
Yeah, while it's been a bit tense, it should get sorted in the next year and year and a half.
I'd say he's probably right. Not great. The submarine deal didn't help things.
Well, I think the relationship, there are tensions at the moment, and all I can really say is I hope that everybody really sort of able to come together to try and work through the relations. I think through the dialogue, I think we can get French-British relations back to a really good place.
As far as, you know, the public is concerned, I think we just have to wait and see how this fleshes out and, you know, give it more time before having any sort of substantial judgment towards it?
I don't know, you're asking the wrong person. That's not something I have an opinion on.
I know after Brexit it might be a little hard, but considering the situation, they're more helping. In this COVID as well situation, a bit supportive, I will say, yeah.
I think it's difficult to say at a political level, probably not too well, but I think generally the populations are very agreeable among those things.
President Macron has been reported as describing Boris Johnson as a clown. What does the public think of this sort of commentary and use of language?
Well, I think it's slanderous. Well, we don't go and elect their presidents over there. They shouldn't be involved in our presidents over here or prime ministers over here.
I'd say Boris has used far worse in the past.
I can't necessarily disagree with the sentiment, but I don't think it was productive in any way.
Well, I wouldn't call him a clown. I'm a big supporter for him.
President Macron seized political capital with the votes he's trying to attract from the nationalist side of the French electorate by attacking Boris Johnson.
I think that is kind of offensive.
I still believe that the rock underneath is that the two nations are more united than they are separated.
It's subjective. It's his own ideal, but he can, yeah, why not? He's a bit of a clown. He's a funny guy.
I don't think it's a good example to set to others, especially the younger generation.
President Macron said that Boris Johnson was a clown. What do you think when people use language like that?
I've seen a lot of videos. They're quite funny, to be honest. But I think he's doing good with vaccine rollout and all of these things. So I think it's quite good. But it's bad, I think, to use clown. But the videos are quite funny.
Probably not clever, because it's You know, you have to play the game.
I think all I want from language and diplomatic relations is people really sort of talking to each other respectfully.
It's a poor choice if you're saying something about a fellow international leader, even if it's behind closed doors, if that's true.
In my opinion, it's not really called for, even if Boris Johnson is a clown, which, you know, might be many people's opinion.
No, I like Boris Johnson. It's all everybody look after. I like Boris Johnson.
I think, yeah, on a certain level, I guess you have to use your words a little bit wiser. But I mean, I wouldn't massively disagree in that respect, to be honest.
Oh, definitely, it's not good. It's not good. They should not use such language against, you know, such great people. You are representing a country, and saying such language like a clown, it's certainly it's not look good for them as well.
I tend to agree with what Macron says.
Why can nobody, including America, seem to improve relations between England and France at the moment?
They haven't done for 1,000 years. Why do they expect it to be for the next 500? I don't think they will be improved.
I think the departure from the European Union says a lot. I think the French, they are particularly big players in the EU, and they weren't too happy when we left. I think Macron and Boris, they don't particularly see eye to eye ideologically, and there's a lot of obvious tensions that go with it.
Probably because Macron is worried about the rise of the far right in France and how that's developing a sort of French nationalism that he'll presumably want to try and emphasise his patriotism, get away from it a little bit. And over here, of course, there has been a lot of mood towards patriotism as well, towards this sort of British nationalism and look how great we are and nothing says Britain is superior, quite like having an argument with the French.
Because we haven't got to those elections in April that will allow the watershed to happen. Either Macron will be back in which case he'll probably be far more relaxed with regard to the UK, or he'll be out and we'll be dealing with somebody else.
I think there's too much mistrust. I think if people talk more, then relationships will improve. I mean, that's how relationships always improve, rather than people just saying what they want to say and closing off to anything that's said up by the opposition, or by the opposite side, I should say.
I think because politics is quite selfish at the moment, so everyone's there's been a turn towards like nationalism, which I don't think helps relations with any countries.
Because we have media that's built on tension, so civil discourse at the moment isn't being prioritised. It's more about making a slogan and getting a statement. So I think until we fix that, we're going to be in the same cycle.
I think it's the United States, it's concentrating on itself for now. So, and that's how it's going to be. The Biden administration has made it clear that our people first. So, yep.
I think basically if people aren't getting along, then it shows that the people involved aren't very good at having open dialogue, aren't able to express themselves and communicate well. So if there's friction between our politicians and other countries, I think that it's a lack of communication skills.
France and Britain appear to have much in common. Both countries have similar populations, with France at 67 million and the UK numbering 67 million. Each has a similar gross domestic product, with the UK turning over, in 2020, around $2.7 trillion and France $2.6 trillion. But these two countries have a surprisingly long record of fighting each other. Over the last 800 years, France and Britain have fought each other in at least 12 different wars. In total over this time, they have been at war for over 200 years, meaning they have fought each other for about one quarter of all the years since before the Middle Ages. In the past, the United States would mediate in the affairs of Europe. But this time, if anything, America has made matters worse. Why does Washington seem so powerless in this situation?
I don't know if they seem so powerless. Maybe they're just fed up of all the silly squabbles that we have over in Europe.
You see the United States withdrawing from all kinds of diplomatic affairs these days. I think they are trying to take a backseat in European affairs in a lot of ways.
Probably because President Joe Biden is focused on his domestic agenda, and after having had some unsuccessful foreign policy elements, I don't think he's eager to throw himself into a complex and hostile situation.
They got the presidents, we got prime minister. However, they've got loads of states and they all run off states. So if, say, Joe Biden wants to make a decision, it has to go through all the states before that decision can be made. So I think it brings their power down.
Well, you've got the leader of the free world is Joe Biden. He is a weak president in many ways.
It's probably not a bad thing if they are powerless at the moment, because they come in where they shouldn't have done far too often.
I don't know if Biden is particularly strong. I think he's having to deal with a lot, and I think America's quite a broken country at the moment due to Donald Trump.
They've got their own domestic problems, which, you know, Biden's trying to sort out, and they've reorientated themselves to the east.
I guess everyone's pretty powerless at the moment because they've got, you know, COVID lurking, and there's huge domestic policies, you know, at stake. There's, you know, there's a massive shortage of money, so, you know, you can't, you know, you have to go backwards before you can go forwards, unfortunately.
Well, I think they're dealing with COVID, and there's intense pressure on the United States to get it right.
America, every country's got their own concerns right now, their own things they need to fix. Last thing they need to worry about is fixing somebody else's problems.
I mean, I feel like they need to sort their own stuff out before getting involved. I think, yeah, they've got their own issues, to be honest. And I don't think they're seen as maybe the best mediator at the moment in the world for that kind of thing.
I think it's not that weak right now, but it was when the Trump was there, so there were so many diplomatic, and there were so many, you know, gangs were forming, like, we are supporting of Trump, we are supporting of those. But I think there were more hatred at that time. Now, when Biden came, so I think it's being, things are changing a little bit.
I think they've got their eye very firmly on Northern Ireland, and there's big problems possibly going to happen there. I hope not. But
with all these divisions, where are relations between the UK, France, Europe, and for that matter, America, heading in the long term?
Britain was very good on its own before. It'll be good in the future. America will be, and France will be as well. As long as they don't interfere with our politics and our justice system, then we'll all be getting on okay.
I think the relationship is strong and will stay strong, and these are all very minor inconveniences.
I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic. Obviously, things are on a downwards turn at the moment, but I think that there are enough people who are committed towards a solution on this, despite the rhetoric, that things will calm, things will get a little bit better.
I'm not saying nothing bad's going to happen, but I think we're more going to stay independent than we used to be with Europe. We'll be more independent.
I think there are short-term problems. Obviously, the EU is still very bitter over the Brexit vote, but we're not coming back.
Well, I think that the presidents are going to change. So soon on after, the relationships are going to change, and I hope that it will be better than now. Yeah.
In the medium term, I'm not that worried. I'm even less worried in the long term. But I believe that as political entities and personalities change, that will return to an even keel. On the other hand, that's with France and Europe in general. Be interesting to see what the new Chancellor makes of us in Germany.
Hopefully for the better, I think. I think that each country needs to engage with their own people, but also with each other.
Maybe tension at the moment, but I think in 5 to 10 years' time, we'll all be looking back at this as a minor footnote.
It's a long, long walk, my friend. It's going to be a long walk. So, who knows?
Hopefully to something understandable, agreeable, civil.
I think that we're living in a world where there's a lot of new challenges, and I think these new challenges are also leading to divisions between other countries.
I don't think we're falling apart at all. I think maybe just better leadership in certain situations would improve, I guess, the forecast of that kind of stuff.
It's headed towards a better shaping of the world. Okay, and these are five major countries, if you see.
Well, just hope everyone, I think, would hope it's just peaceful and people can just relearn how to reconnect and
be a bit more agreeable, I think.
In my opinion, it's probably just going to get worse as global warming, especially global warming gets worse. I think that there'll be more call from the public for governments to be more self-serving rather than actually a more of a kind of global approach, which